Standing in the Alpha Beta parking lot, watching the sunset. I'll never forget watching all the reds and oranges slip away, letting go of yet another dirty day.
This is Matt Hoist on the Dave Congleton Show, KBEC News Talk 920 AM, 96.5 FM. Where'd you get that song?
Cake.
I'm not hip enough to have ever heard it, but, you know, my first job was at an Alpha Beta, so...
Is it in that Alpha Beta parking lot?
That resonates with me. I spent lots of time in an Alpha Beta parking
Sacramento
lot.
Sacramento band.
Okay. Anyways, we are here with Noah Rothman. He is the author of Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. He is associate editor of Commentary Magazine and an MSNBC NBC contributor. Noah, thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
So give us the bird's eye view of Unjust. Tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, sure. So most Americans probably don't have a ton of experience with modern social justice activists, but they're familiar with what social justice is, or at least I'm sure they think they are, because it's a pretty anodyne concept in the abstract, something really American, in fact, righting historical wrongs, understanding how to think about a just society and whatnot. In the hands of its activist class, however, it has become something much more pernicious. It has become the antithesis of the kind of blind, objective justice we seek in a courtroom. Its advocates have embraced concepts that are antithetical to the American ideal, that are incompatible with American institutions. The idea that meritocracy is a myth, for example, that you can't overcome the circumstances of your birth, that your course in life is in many ways predestined as a result of them, that separatism is a good thing explicitly because it prevents social discomfort, and that colorblindness in institutions is naive at best and probably dangerous. And the thing about this is that white supremacists believe all this too. The social justice left and the white nationalist right have, the distinctions between them are so blurred that I frequently decline to make them. These are obstacles in the pathway to achieving racial equality, racial justice, and institutional justice. And this book is hopefully an attempt to identify this pernicious ideology, to stigmatize it, and to reacquaint Americans with the very old notions that have buttressed the American experiment, that institutions should be dedicated to equality. And when institutions treat people unequally, that's not justice.
So I've been listening to the audiobook of your book over the weekend. I am as far as, I just got into chapter 6, sadly, so I have not finished it.
You're far along.
I got to the one, you know, it's a chapter entitled Victimhood or Victimology?
Victimocracy.
Victimocracy. Noah, I am a white male. Am I a victim?
Well, it depends on your outlook, right? I mean, ideally, this is certainly not something that is empowering, but it is certainly attractive. The notion that you are not responsible for your lot in life, that powers that are ill-defined and ubiquitous have stolen that which is your due, and that you should appeal to a strong hand to restore it, that's a powerful organizing force, and it's liberating in a way, even though it robs you of agency in the process. I mean, this is something that conservatives have long known, that this kind of identity politics is pernicious and dangerous to the social fabric, but it's really powerful, and it's attractive to politicians who are trying to form political coalitions. So increasingly, as the right begins to borrow from something that the left has long known, that this kind of identity politics is really an easy source of political authority and power, it's becoming much more dangerous and much more accepted as a broad political fact of just organizing. And I think that's dangerous. I think it's something that needs to be arrested.
So what does that look like more specifically? When a politician is going after identity politics, what sorts of things do they do in order to kind of gather those forces to their side?
Well, for the social justice left, it is to suggest that there are classes, ill-defined, but classes nonetheless, of individuals who benefit from historical conditions of which they may not even be aware, that institutions are dedicated to the preservation of privilege and authority on those classes, and that there's really no way for you to navigate this complex labyrinth of prejudices without the aid of beneficent liberal Sherpas, that somebody has to hold your hand and walk you through life. They're selling you something. The alternative on the right, the mirror image of that, would be a lot of the themes to which Donald Trump appealed in the primary process, where he suggested that you are not just looked down upon by the powers that be, but you are actively discriminated against. If you're white, male, heterosexual, Christian, what have you, these traits are not just disfavored now, but actively the subject to prejudice, that labor has been imported for the benefit of globalist elites, that unfair competition from foreign sources of capital and trade benefit only a select group of individuals who are well-placed in society and not society as a whole, contrary to a lot of market theory that has previously buttressed the conservative movement. These ideas rob you of agency. They render you manipulable, and they sap you of the capacity to understand that you can affect change in your own life, that you have agency and merit and authority. And it's really powerful for a politician, but it's psychologically damaging for individuals to embrace this sort of thing. It renders you paranoid and bitter and vindictive, and that's more and more what the social justice movement looks like.
How would you go about inoculating people? I mean, what's the solution? Well, how do you inoculate people from this sort of belief and get, you know, the cliche of, you know, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, and that there are things you can do, you know, to improve your lot in life? It seems like, you know, you talked about, you know, liberal Sherpas, you know, carrying people, you know, guiding people through this sort of thing. You know, it seems to me that a lot of these college campuses, you know, the despite the fact they, you know, wail about the patriarchy and that sort of stuff, that those aren't necessarily right-wing institutions anymore and haven't been for at least a generation.
No. And so the book is not an argument against self-actualization or racial awareness or having difficult conversations with people who don't share your experiences. That's to argue from a position of ignorance, and I don't do that. I think that's very valuable. But to prescribe for institutions this sort of downward negative social leveling, no more are we talking about individuals as individuals, but more classes and representatives of their respective tribes, not people who have individual mitigating circumstances who deserve to be lifted up, but whole classes that are due a comeuppance. And that sort of vindictive nature is, again, what constitutes this movement. So once you begin to identify that, hopefully this book begins to give you a roadmap for identifying these individuals who are really trying to sell you something. And sometimes quite literally, this phenomenon of woke capitalism, where brands, now the highest purpose of these brands is to embrace some sort of a social cause that isn't really politics, but resembles politics. It mimics the passions of politics. And that is the way in which politics is practiced increasingly now for people on the right and the left. Poll after poll shows that people want their brands to have some sort of a social stance, and that way they can affect their politics and literally wear their politics on their sleeve. Hopefully this book demonstrates that you were being taken for a ride here, and it shows the effect of how manipulable and gullible this ideology makes you, and then again how it robs you of agency and how it steals from you political power in the form of making yourself an attractive member of a political coalition. The best example of that is the Women's March, how the Women's March adopted the ideology of intersectionality and then was unable to look at its allies as allies because they possessed discrete traits. And some members of their coalition, no matter how much they agreed with them, were possessed these traits that rendered them purveyors of white supremacy in the words of Tamika Mallory, which is why her fellow organizers who happen to be Jewish couldn't quite be members of the same coalition. In the process, they rendered themselves unattractive members of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party had to distance themselves from this ideology. So even if they thought it was empowering, it ended up disempowering them. The argument here is really sort of in self-interest, that you have some things that you want to get done at the polls, and these ideas, maybe you find them attractive, maybe not, it doesn't matter. It's making our life and your life and everyone's life who believes in these ideas harder.
We're talking with Noah Rothman, author of Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. We take your calls if you're interested in asking Noah some questions about this, about how we kind of break down some of these walls between us. How, you know, can we tolerate each other in public life anymore? Give us a call, 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. This is Matt Hoy hosting the Dave Conkleton Show on 920 AM KVEC 96.5 FM.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town.
This is Matt Hoy in for Dave Congleton on Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM KVEC, 96.5 FM. We've got Noah Rothman, author of Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America, on with us. If you are interested in getting in on the conversation, give us a call, 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. Noah, when I was in college, there was the debate was, you know, is America a melting pot or a salad bowl? And the idea with the first one is that, you know, we take all of these cultures from around the world and we come up with something uniquely American. Or it's a salad bowl and you've got all of these different ingredients and they're in the same bowl and they're each different, but you can kind of enjoy them. Are we allowed to make either of those kind of comparisons anymore? Or, you know, do you have to keep all the ingredients separate?
Well, unfortunately, separatism has become the new vogue. Places, and especially on college campuses, the pretense that this kind of demographic, racial, or otherwise distinct spaces has something to do with study has finally been abandoned. These are no longer complementary lifestyles that augment a field of study. It is about, in the words of one administrator who wrote for the Washington Post, quote, preventing uncomfortable learning. Outside of the classroom, just in daily social interactions. And I find the notion that just experiences with other people who don't happen to share your demographic signifiers extremely pernicious. It's antithetical to the American idea, the experiment, which is a melting pot. I mean, there's an ideology on the right, or an idea on the right now, that is gaining some steam, which holds that immigrant groups are no longer assimilating at rates comparable to what rates were like in the 19th century, for example, and all the social science we have suggests that's not true. But there's a real hostility on the left to even the idea of assimilation, that assimilation into American culture is bad, is dangerous, not just for these immigrant groups, but because this somehow perfect idealized Rousseauian notion of these cultures in isolation will be tainted by association with American culture. It's very strange and it's a little self-hating, and it really doesn't bear any resemblance to the kind of American ideal that our founders strive for and that most Americans, I think, continue to appreciate, the notion that cultures can mix and interact, and that nothing is lost in the transaction. There's this vogue idea of cultural appropriation, which seems to suggest that culture can be stolen. But culture defies notions of ownership, because, again, nothing is lost in this transaction. There's only augmentation involved. So, yes, I think that it's a melting pot. It's not a salad bowl. This is not a... You can have this opinion, and we can have this opinion, and we can agree to disagree. There really is one right answer here.
We've got a caller for Noah.
Yeah,
who
we got
Craig?
Michael in Paso. You're on.
Hello, Noah. How are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
Good. You know, the subject is so important, especially now as we see more division, more identity politics, where you have certain segments of your population trying to be divided up, and so therefore you have such animosity between groups. And when you really get down to the root of it, and there is some issue with the whole idea and concept of maybe not being paranoid, but people are seeing especially at the low end of the employment ladder, where you have, you know, an oversupply of labor coming in from very dependent third world countries, and then you see the result of that sort of oversupply of labor affecting American workers and legal residents in very negative ways, especially as they attempt to get on the employment ladder. And what that, I think, tends to do, and I'd like to your guest to comment on this, is it tends to create a lot of animosity, and it also tends to create a permanent underclass of people, which is not what the American system was ever set up to be. Upward mobility has always been a part of the American dream. Everybody's heard that. And that seems to have been lost, especially within the last, I would say, 30 to 40 years. And you see it big time in California.
Noah?
Yeah, so sure. So I agree with just about all of that. So in basic economics, like the fundamental economic notion is that when you have wages and labor rates tend to equalize across borders when you have flow along those lines. So American labor has always been pretty expensive since the dawn of the founding, because we've had a pretty tight labor market just about since the beginning of time, which is why we're such an innovative culture, in part because we've had to compensate for a lack of cheap labor in this country. And when you have a tight labor market like that, there's obviously these kind of tensions that will result, and that's natural, and especially, there's a kind of tribal impulse, and tribalism is really the human condition. I mean, it's so ingrained in human culture across not just American culture, all cultures. It's probably an evolutionary trait. It's so universal. It's probably something we adopted when we're just as a survival instinct. One thing I do disagree with is something you said, however, is the notion of a permanent underclass. There really are no permanent classes in this country. Economic churn is as vibrant and as lively as it has ever been. There really are no permanent fortunes in this country. The Forbes 500 list does not include any names from the 19th century, which is quite unlike the experience in European countries, where fortunes are inherited and remain within that family for generation upon generation. There is upward mobility in this country. It is something that is unique and dynamic and resonant within the American experience. And in periods of, ironically, it's a good problem to have, because the problems you identify are the problems of having a strong economy. When you have a negative economy, wealth tends not to move, and that's when you begin to have stable classes. This is something that probably is a feature of life. You're never going to have a perfect system in which everybody gets along, especially when there's competition. But competition is a good thing. Competition is something we should welcome, even if it creates social discomfort at times.
Thanks for the question.
We got a break coming up, guys.
I'm sorry. We got to take a break.
Oh, okay.
We'll be right back with Noah Rothman, Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America, here on KVEC, Dave Collinson Show. Listening to the Dave Congleton Show. I'm Matt Hoy, sitting in for Dave as he recovers from heart surgery. We have with us Noah Rothman, author of Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. He's also an associate editor of Commentary Magazine. If you like listening to him today, you can get more Noah by listening to the subscribing to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Is that right?
That is right. And occasionally I'll show up on MSNBC once in a while.
Okay. So, Noah, tell our listeners about Portland and burritos.
Yeah, well, we were talking about cultural appropriation in the last segment, and you, sir, you've managed to get through what is my favorite chapter in the book, Entry-Level Politics, which is an increasing fad. Engaging in politics is a good thing, right? And we should encourage it, and we have encouraged it, and the barriers to the entry into discourse have been reduced as the tools for engaging in that discourse have proliferated, namely the Internet. But there's a downside to that, and the downside is that the erudition of that discourse, it's no longer especially high-minded. In fact, it's pretty bottom of the barrel in a lot of ways, and that's a really perfect example of it, how this fad of pop politics, which really isn't politics but resembles politics, it's mostly pop culture, has become a substitute for talking about politics writ large, policy, legislative affairs, votes, elections, that sort of thing. It's not really about politics, but it feels like it. And Kook's Burritos was a victim of this sort of thing. The fad of cultural appropriation, which has become a big thing on the left, stems from a, like so much of social justice activism, a noble place. It suggests that culture should be cherished and privileged by those who appreciate it, and it should be safeguarded against those who would cheapen it or dumb it down only to exploit it for its cultural value. That's an understandable sentiment. But how it manifests increasingly is what happened to these people who ran Kook's Burritos. It was a group of two women who went to Mexico, appreciated the food, learned some recipes, brought it back home, established a place, and were very successful. And success was their downfall. It became a fixation of the social justice press out there, the Mercury and Mike.com, to hound these women out of business. They attacked them for failing to appropriately compensate, they said, the individuals who gave them these recipes. They said they were profiting off the work of the indigenous people of Mexico. White women who were generating an income from the labor of black and brown people south of the border, and they were presumed to be enemies, and as a result, their business had to be folded. They were hounded, they were threatened, their lives were ruined as a result of this crusade. Nobody knew anything about them. All of these were stereotypes and assumptions. Mm-hmm. And another feature of this is that success, more often than not, is the trigger. Not necessarily the cultural appropriation or the transgression du jour, but the fact that they're successful at it. And it's not just them, it's many other individuals who have enjoyed some sort of success in their life as a result of their own efforts and labor and ingenuity, who are brought low by this really very shallow and pernicious and bad faith acting mob of people who think they're acting in the name of historical justice, but they're really just affecting the most trite and petty grievance politics and destroying lives in the process.
So if they hadn't made such good burritos, they wouldn't have been targeted?
Probably. That's my assumption. It's the same with the scientist Timothy Hunt and another individual who was working on a European Space Agency program to land a lander on a comet.
This is the guy with the shirt, right?
Yeah, the guy with the shirt, yeah. he had a shirt made for him by a female friend featuring some cartoon women scantily clad, and the woman wanted to see it on TV, and when they put it on TV, an Atlantic writer was deeply offended by this, said it was single-handedly driving women out of science, mathematics, engineering, and technology. And he was, again, hounded until he was forced to appear again on television in tears. The scientist Timothy Hunt was making some self-effacing joke about how he met his wife in a laboratory environment and said, you know, the women shouldn't do sciences because they something along the lines of they encounter monsters like me and we fall in love with them and make them cry. This is, again, self-effacing remarks of a 70-year-old man. You don't even need to know the nonverbal cues that would accompany a joke to know that that's a joke.
Right.
But an individual who is very, I believe, jealous of that this individual's success decided to bring him low by suggesting that this was a misogynistic person in a position of power who was making patriarchal flippant remarks at this conference, and he was forced to resign his station and the honor society to which he was a member as a result of the outcry. The successful are targeted by this, in part because I think this movement just genuinely resents success. They perceive it to be an ill-gotten good. It's not your own making anyway. It's the result of these historical conditions into which you are born. So why not have it robbed from you? That's only just.
We're talking with Noah Rothman, author of Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. If you want to get in on the conversation, call-in numbers are 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. I lived up in Washington State for about 2 years, and I can tell you the whole Pacific Northwest could really use some good burritos because it's tough to find up there. So... You know, one of the things that strikes me about, especially the story with the guy with the shirt, is it's an Atlantic writer. It's not some, you know, fly-by-night, you know, Jezebel.com or, you know, Gawker or something like that. It's the Atlantic. How much of this has kind of infiltrated and is running... You know, in what would be mainstream, normal news operations. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, middle-aged guys like me, if I were still in journalism, I spent 15 years in newspapers, would allow that sort of stuff to be published. But it seems like it's almost a side effect of a lot of journalism. You know, hiring young people straight out of school for, you know, dirt cheap money, and they just, you know, have embraced this social justice warrior stuff and haven't and bring it into the real world, and it's almost like, you know, a crash. It's almost like an old Spike Jones album where, you know, Spike Jones is murdering the classics, and it's all these cymbals and noise and whatnot.
And it's usually young people, as you say, sort of the cultural revolutionary aspect of this, which seeks, you know, purges. And it's very excessively represented in the fields of journalism and media. But in the case of the guy with the shirt, that wasn't published on anything but Twitter. This is social media in particular gives these people microphones and allows them to bypass an editor's judgment who would never allow that to be published on a platform. And so it creates this pretty modest row, and this is a self-selected group, people on Twitter, and so they select for individuals who are more outraged by this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it creates the impression, when you generate this kind of buzz and you create a quote-unquote mob around an issue, they're very short-lived. They're usually like 72 hours long, and if you can hunker down, you'll survive it. But the impression is that's created by these outrage cycles is disproportionate numbers relative to their actual influence. It feels like you're being swarmed by a critical mass of individuals who are united in outrage, but it is really actually a very minor selected group of people who move on relatively quickly if you can get past it. But more often than not, employers in particular, companies with a fiduciary responsibility to somebody, buckle under this pressure because it feels like it's insurmountable. It's really not. The numbers, they wield influence disproportionate to their numbers. And I don't mean to overinflate this issue. We're talking about the fringes of the fringes here in this book. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it's the center that is beginning to draw increasingly from the ideas on these fringes and mainstream them. And that is what needs to be stopped. You can stigmatize and isolate these individuals because they're still small enough to be able to do that in number. But once those ideas achieve terminal velocity, escape velocity, as it were, and become mainstream, then it's much more harder to expurgate them from the movements that they represent.
And that was a question I was going to ask you. Are we really talking about the fringes of the fringes? Because, you know, you talk about, you know, there's an effort on the part of social justice warriors to remove the blindfold from Lady Justice and have her look at the parties in the case and take that into account. And you've had, you know, President Obama's Supreme Court nominees. You had, you know, Sonia Sotomayor talk about, you know, well, she's better at this judging thing because she's a wise Latina. And Obama saying that he is looking for judges who have empathy. And, you know, that if to have empathy, you need to look at the parties who are before you. And, you know, you generally don't have empathy for these big heartless corporations. But according to the letter of the law, you know, that might be who you need to, you know, come. You may need to come down on their side. So, you know, how much are we already to where we're not with the fringe, but we're becoming more and more mainstream?
Yeah, well, we're getting there. You know, so I kind of, in a paradigmatic sense, just thinking just how you approach life, I have a lot less of a problem with people who look at individuals as individuals and identify the individual extenuating or moderating circumstances and say this person is due a certain amount of deference from institutions that they weren't privy to for their in other facets of their life. Where I have more sympathy for that, although it is problematic too, than I do the increasing view of the social justice left and right, that it isn't individuals at all who we should be talking about, but distinct groups. And we're no longer talking about individual circumstances that should yield someone more opportunities than they were privy to in their life, but we're talking more about people who've had too many opportunities in the subjective view of the individual judging them, and because of the class into which they were born, and therefore they should be robbed of those opportunities. There's a case before the Department of Justice right now. The Trump Justice Department has adopted a lawsuit against Harvard University and other institutions that are actively discriminating against Asian Americans because they are so successful. And
we just lost him.
The government.
There we go.
The man.
It's a plot.
Yeah.
We have to take a break anyways. We're going to try and get Noah Rothman back on the line. You are listening to The Dave Congleton Show on 920 AM and 96.5 FM. This is Matt Hoy in for Dave Congleton on the Dave Congleton Show on 920 AM and 96.5 FM. We're talking with Noah Rothman, author of Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Last chance, if you want to get a call in, a question for Noah, number is 805-543-8830 or 1-800-549-5832. So, Noah, in your book, you talk about James Damore, who is a Google engineer who kind of made people angry and is no longer a Google engineer. Can you talk a little bit about his situation? And can you kind of answer the question, you know, can we work together anymore? Can people who have differing social and political views get along enough to work together? Or are cases like James Damore and, you know, Kevin Williamson's brief stint at The Atlantic, where he was hired and then fired almost immediately, is that the new normal?
Well, I mean, it is in these institutions that hire these very young cultural revolutionary types who can't stand having somebody who disagrees with them. So that's definitely going to be a feature, unfortunately, of the modern social justice movement. It's just one that I think is so radioactive that it has increasingly less appeal to the critical masses of voters who make up the coalitions, the Democratic and Republican coalition. These are the fringes of the fringes. Again, I think they're modest in number. They're just very appealing in ideology. It's just what we need to stigmatize this ideology. Damore, in particular, I talk about him in Chapter 3 about the unassailable truths that are treated as though they're violations of a religious concept because they're so treated with such hostility. He was a Google engineer who said, you know, one of the reasons why there's not a lot of women in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, is because they don't want to be there. They just make different choices in their lives. And you can affect some sort of discriminatory regime that privileges women over men, but that's not going to change these individual choices. And that was called, that was attacked. He didn't break any rules, but the individuals who were offended by him insisted that he had, and then the management committed to this, this dissection of the rules in order to find a way to fire him, and they did. One of the fun things about this is actually really illustrative of the themes I talk about in my book. Google committed to an internal review and found that it hadn't been underpaying women. In fact, it had been underpaying men. And so it is going about addressing that inequality. And in the New York Times article on this, you have a very revealing quote from an individual who is very frustrated by the fact that men are now going to be making as much as their female employees. I'm going to read from the New York Times article, quote, Google seems to be advancing a, quote, flawed and incomplete sense of equality, unquote, by making sure men and women receive similar salaries for similar work, said Joel Emerson, chief executive of Paradigma, as a consulting company. Literally, the dictionary definition of equality is perpetuating inequality in the name of this individual, and this guy's idea. This is at the heart of what I talk about in this book. Equality, as we understand it, treating people equally, is bad. It's not ideal. It's not something that's even desirable. We should be treating people unequally in order to achieve some sort of karmic notion of fairness that never works. It makes people bitter, angry, and it sows aggression that spans generation. It's not how politics in this country works. It really shouldn't be. And we have to go about making sure that this is the sort of idea that is stigmatized again as it properly should be.
Yeah, I saw that article today over Ars Technica, and it just... It blew my mind, frankly, that you know, Google went and it did all the research and it looked for similar people doing similar work in similar places and found out that the men were getting short shrift. So,
and I mean, this should be a good thing, right?
Right.
I mean, we're not discriminating against women. Why aren't everybody celebrating in the streets?
It's more money
because
in the pockets
of
employees.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It's more money in the pockets of employees.
Yeah, I don't think equality is the objective here. It never really was. And they talk a good game, but equality isn't the objective. Raising women up isn't the objective. It is putting men in their place because they are perceived to be individuals who have benefited from historical circumstances of which they may not even be aware. This is the whole root of the social justice movement today. It is no longer about lifting people up who deserve it. It is about tamping people down.
So what's the solution? Noah Rothman has been put in charge of government and society for the next 24 hours. What do you do? What are some concrete steps that can be taken to get us out of this situation where, you know, left is right, up is down, and we can, you know, aspire more to what this, you know, the base that this country is founded on?
Well, I prescribe some approaches, but it's not a top-down solution. We didn't get here from the top-down. We got here from the bottom-up, and the only solution will be bottom-up. So, unfortunately, even if I had dictatorial powers over social evolution and government, it wouldn't change a thing. And that's part of the reason why, I mean, I'm very loath as a conservative to even advocate legislative ideas, although I do think we need to reemphasize civic education in this country, not social studies, not demographic studies, but civic education. In the form of reading the Federalist Papers, not just the Constitution, but people like Burke and Rousseau and Montesquieu and the individuals who really animated the founders and led them to adopt the ideology that resulted in our form of government.
Dead
but beyond
white guys.
That, it's about creating a paradigm in which we all agree that this stuff is frustrating our ambitions, our political ambitions, and so we need to stigmatize it, root it out, and isolate and marginalize it. And I can't demand that happen. I can't create a societal condition where we all agree that that's the new norm. But it has been done in the past, and I identify some ways in which it has been achieved. and some models to appeal to for both the right and the left, and I think that's the way to go about it. But it's not going to be any one person saying, okay, snap your fingers and say, okay, this is what has to be done now. We all have to come to a consensus.
And you talk about, you know, reading some, for lack of a better term, old dead white guys, which is not going to win you many plaudits among the social justice left. But what sorts,
But we just haven't improved on these ideas. I mean, you can't, there is no improvement upon the notion that all men are created equal. Just, there's nowhere to go from there but down. The idea of fundamental English common law concepts like the presumption of innocence doesn't get any better than that, frankly. Mm-hmm. We haven't identified as an alternative to that that doesn't create more victims, that doesn't create more injustice. It's probably unpopular to say it, but these ideas are relatively perfected, and they require defense. And it's only somebody who's really enamored with themselves and is possessed of some cosmic hubris that would think that they can improve on the notions at the root of the ideals of liberty in the heart of the American founding, that individuals should be treated as individuals and judged on their actions and not those of their father.
Are we at rock bottom yet?
No.
Okay.
Not even close. We're not even close. This is the very beginning of what could be a very dangerous downward trend. We're in a good place. We can still affect some real positive change and isolate and marginalize this small group.
Thanks, Noah, for your time. We are out of time. You've been listening to The Dave Congleton Show, 920 AM, 96.5 FM.